you've got to sort of walk right out to the end of the gangplank and be prepared to be pushed off.
Could you take us on the journey of how you got
the thing that I learned about being a producer? Kind of
whatever it's taken to get to this point.
A completely different perspective.
Found. That's my job.
Producing Heroes, a Circa podcast.
Hi, it's Yaron. Thanks for joining us to meet today's producing hero, David Lan. David is a polymath, anthropologist, playwright, director, artistic director, and of course, creative producer. As artistic director of the Young Vic, he was instrumental in reshaping British theatre into something bold, adventurous, and utterly compelling. He has published books including The Brilliant, As If By Chance, been appointed a CBE, and he's won 2 Olivier Awards. But neither of them were for acting, nor for directing, nor for writing. What were they for, David, and what does that tell us about your career in the theatre?
First one, I got for a season of work that I produced at the Young Vic. I mean, the thing that was good about it, that was fun about it, was that it was for a whole season of work. So it was for many, many people. It's for many, many people who have done many, many things. And also what was fun about it was that I got it collectively in the third year that I'd run the theatre. So it was great in that way because you think, oh, okay, we're not totally screwing everything up. We sort of just keep doing more or less what you're doing now. The more recent one I got when I left the Young Vic, and you may say they went, well, thank God for that. Let's give an award. But that was for running the theatre for almost 20 years. But it was for producing. I mean, that's really your question. I am a writer. I am a director. But the principal work that I did for that period of time was producing shows, running the theatre.
And I think what interested me about the particular construction of those awards is that there isn't exactly a category for that. Then in fact, it sort of has to edge its way through via other kind of mediums, because the producing work that you did at the Young Vic was extraordinary, but there isn't a category that says creative producer, or very seldom in our theatrical world.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, I guess it's why people create these categories of special awards in order to mop up the people that don't fit into the categories that have come down to us, sort of since the Greeks, as it were. I guess so. I guess that's right. There isn't. I mean, the particular award I got has gone to other producers, but it's tended to be, when that has happened, it's tended to be in the commercial world. And it was the first time that somebody in one of the subsidized theatres. No, not true. I mean, when Nicholas Heitner left the National, he got it. It's not unprecedented.
It interests me, this relationship between the commercial and the subsidized. I've seen shows you produced in the subsidized world, but I've also seen, you know, View from a Bridge in New York. And I'm interested in the osmotic nature of those categories and what is different, what is the same between working between those worlds.
We only produced once directly into the West End here, into the commercial theatre here. And that was very late in my time there. And the reason that we did it was because some of the shows, well, I guess over the period, maybe 10, I can't remember the number, but 10, 12 shows, I don't know, moved into the commercial theatre. And sometimes there were shows which we moved because there was a very big audience and because of very popular shows, as straightforward as that. And we were happy to do that. But the thing that began to interest me was whether the work that we were producing, which I thought was unusual aesthetically, would gain traction in the West End. And when we did shows like the show you mentioned, of View from the Bridge, which we did simply because I wanted to produce it. I mean, the work we produced at the Young Vic while I was there was the work I wanted to see produced. I wanted to see it. I want to see that idea or that show or that play in that production. And the only way I'm going to get to do that is if I produce it. So I'm going to produce it. And trusting that there would be enough other people. It's only a 450-seat theatre. There'd be enough other people who would share my taste and want to come. And often enough, there were. Sometimes, of course, there wasn't, but often enough, there were. But when we did things like A View from the Bridge, which were thought to be, wow, this is extraordinary. I've never seen anything like that before. And then you move it into the commercial theatre, and it does really, really well. And people really go for it, think it's great, and are excited by it, despite the fact that it's very unlike what you might expect to find in the commercial theatre. And then, as you say, we moved it to Broadway, and it did incredibly well on Broadway and won all the awards. You go, well, okay, this is interesting now. Could you do that directly into the West End? Or if you tried that, will the audience go, oh, we don't like this? So we did a production of A Cat in the Hudson Roof directly into the West End. But I produced it in the West End exactly like I would have produced it at the Young Vic. and it had a set which a design for the play, which was very unlike what you might expect for a Tennessee Williams play. I mean, the commercial theatre, it was rather abstract. It was the same director, designer team as had produced Streetcar for me at the Young Vic. And what was so interesting was that the audience in the West End, they didn't go, gosh, what is this? They just came to see the show. And it did very, very, very well. I mean, it did very well. It had a very, very strong cast. It didn't have a superstar strong cast. It had a very strong cast. But it did incredibly well. You go, oh, this is interesting. The work which I love is also loved by hundreds of thousands of other people. And that's great. But you've got to do it in order to find that out.
And one might suggest that part of the reason it's loved is because you helped create that space. I mean, I think one of the things producers produce are audiences. I love the Peter Drucker quote that the purpose of a business is to create a customer. And I think in a way, things were possible on the West End after things like View from a Bridge that weren't possible before. It became suddenly more capable of being serious, it seems to me, than it had been before.
That may be true. It's difficult judgment for me to make. Certainly, the way I used to talk about what we were doing at the Young Vic, this strapline that we used for many years was great shows for great audiences. And I was very aware, and I used to say all the time to the people I work with, that we are creating an audience. We are creating the show and then we're creating the audience. And the game is to bring those two things together. But we've got to create the right audience for the right work. And then you just hope that the right audience, by which I mean, the right audience for me is anybody. There's people who go to theatre all the time and people who never been to theatre before. And the sort of challenge was to produce the work I wanted to see in a way that people who go to the Royal Opera House and people who live in the estate across the road would both have a good time at. You know, I mean, somebody said something interesting to me in New York. I work now quite a lot in New York, and we were talking about a couple of shows that were on Broadway. And I said, yeah, it's extraordinary that work is on Broadway. And the person I was talking to, who runs a theatre in New York, a not-for-profit in New York, said to me, yes, but it was A View from the Bridge on Broadway that started that made that possible. And I hadn't seen that. I hadn't expected that. And it may be true, may not be true. I don't really know. But I think we are dependent. I mean, it's why the subsidized theatre in this country, in the UK, is so critical, because we are privileged to be able to do the crazy things that we love. And in the knowledge, I suppose, that if we find that there isn't an audience for them, the board will replace us with somebody who can do the job better than we do it. But you've got to sort of walk right out to the end of the gangplank and be prepared to be pushed off.
David, you said in your book that you only ever had one idea for Eva Van Hove,
being A View from a Bridge. And I absolutely share your estimation of that play as having this kind of mystery that many of the other Millers don't. But I'm really incredibly interested in where that Hossense Geiger countenance that allows you to zero in on an idea and a creator and match them with such kind of perfect pitch. Where does that come from, and what percentage of the time is it on?
Oh, I think it's probably always there, though maybe not always in perfect working order. It's interesting, that one. I mean, it's a play I've been thinking about for a long time, and I tried to get it off the ground once before. I'd had the idea of doing that play because it's about immigrants to the US, and the heart of the play is a particular culture of honor, which is challenged in the play by the way the story is told. But I had the idea of doing the play with actors not from Sicily, as in the original, but from one of the Spanish-speaking American islands, which would mean that they would be Latinos, or they'd be black people. And I wrote to Miller's agent at the time, this was many years ago, and asked whether we could do that. And the answer just came back, no. It came back, no, and don't ask again, which is interesting. And Mr. Miller is not open to discussion on the subject of no. Well, all right, fine, pity. I mean, subsequently, of course, Miller's plays have been done in various ways and with actors from various cultural backgrounds. But at that point, this is maybe 15 years ago, I don't know. The other word was just no. But the play was in my mind, and I love the play. I mean, he's, of course, a great writer. All his plays are in their different ways. But that's the key one, I think. And when I find somebody that I want to work with, I really want to work with, and the first time I saw anything of Ivo Van Hove's was his Roman Tragedies, which I sort of bumped up against by chance in Vienna. I just went, yeah, I want this. I mean, this is one of the best things I've ever seen in my whole life. is probably impossible. I remember watching Hamilton in like the sixth performance or something at the Public and sitting there going, I want this. I'm going to see Oscar Eustace Alton saying, Oscar, I think we could do this. And Oscar going, yeah. But and I had this, you know, when I saw Evo's show, I thought I'd probably get that response. And it took a long time. It took a long time. But what I did, and what I tended to do with people whose work I wanted to produce in my theatre, in Europe, because so many theatres have their own acting companies and can keep work in the repertoire for a long time, it's possible to buzz around from Paris to Berlin to Vienna to Warsaw, wherever it is. And you can, and I saw a lot of Ivo's work. I mean, maybe six shows in various places. And that was essential for me to try and understand who the person is and where do we go next and what is, and am I right or am I wrong? So, I'm sort of dodging the question because I can't really answer it. I remember, though, if I remember anything, is where it happened, you know, exactly where I was. I can remember the space, the room, the disposition, where I was standing, where the light was and so on. And I remember where I was when I went, oh, View from the Bridge. Yeah, that's the one. That's the one. And I talked to Ivo's close colleague, Wouter van Rensburg. And I said to Wouter, look, I think I've got an idea here. What about A View from the Bridge? And Wouter, who's super, super smart, and of course knows Ivo very well. And I remember, I can see his face, and I'm saying this now, as he sort of took that in, as he sort of thought about it, he went, yes, I think he may be onto something. What Ivo is a genius at is the sort of micropolitics of emotional sexual relationships. That's his genius. And there was something about if you get that sort of forensic theatrical intelligence on that play, something interesting will happen. And it did, yeah.
I'm interested in the nature of chance. You mentioned that you encountered Ivo van Hove's work through seeing the Roman tragedies, and your first encounter with the Benedict Andrews play was by being invited by chance at the Schaubühne into it. And I'm interested in this relation between chance and producing.
So, okay, let me try and do both those together. I saw Ivo's show because I was in Vienna because I co-produced a show directed by Luca Bondi with the Vienna Festival. So we opened that show, and I remember the morning after our show opened, saying to one of my co-producers, who's Ruth McKenzie, okay, I've got an evening, what should I go see? And Ruth said, well, I've heard there's this Dutch Shakespeare show. Let's go and see that. Okay. In Berlin, the Benedict Andrews event, Tobias Veit, who runs the Schaubühne in Berlin, Tobias said to me, look, there is another show. I can't remember whether he said, I think you should go and see it, but that was implicit in it. It was Tobias helping me and saying, look, I think this will be of interest to you. So it's chance I happen to be there. But on the other hand, it's friendship more than that. You set up, if you're lucky, networks or just connections with people who are sympathetic to what you're doing and want to help. And they say, what about this? What about that? And sometimes you can follow it up and sometimes you can't. But I mean, I talked to Tobias about that afterwards and he went, yeah, I think Benedict is somebody for you. You go, yeah, you're right. And the experience of seeing that production of Benedict's, which actually was also a streetcar named Desire. I mean, like within moments of it beginning, I went, yeah, I want this. I think I know what to do with that.
There's a quote that I love from Andrei Tarkovsky, the film director, where he says, it's only possible to communicate with the audience if one ignores the 80% or so of people who for some reason have got it into their heads that we're supposed to entertain them. I'm really interested in this idea of what is the role of balancing or understanding the role of entertainment versus the role of art and how they function. And if you see that having changed over the course of your producing career.
I used to sort of shock people or upset people a little bit by saying I'm not interested in entertainment. It's not my job to entertain people. And I hate the idea that people have boring jobs and then they go to art to be entertained. Terrible. It's not what we're not here to keep a terrible social and economic system to help to make it viable. I don't like that. Also, when you think about what many people find entertaining, I don't find that a useful concept. I prefer to talk in much simpler language and just say, I want people to have a good time. But have a good time throughout, the whole experience. It's not just when you click on the equivalent of Netflix and then go into that universe for a couple of hours. Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that Tarkovsky quote, but it's very good. The thing is, what I found is people want to be deeply engaged. They want to be deeply engaged. And it's only when you engage them deeply, which, you know, in whatever way, it could be funny, it could be laughing, which is, you know, what's sort of thought to be entertaining. But it's the depth of the engagement, which is what you're after. And also the depth of engagement with a wide range of different people of different experience at the same time. I mean, that's what's exciting. I mean, that's the payback. That's when you go, yeah, okay, whatever it's cost, whatever it's taken to get to this point where it's happening, that's great. So, and is that entertaining people? I mean, now I'm involved, as we all are, I've no doubt, in trying to find ways of holding on to theatres which are so profoundly challenged by the virus. You know, people talk a lot about the entertainment industry, and I go along with it because we need all to be together on this. The last thing anyone needs is me saying, oh, I'm not really interested. Yeah. No, it's great. That's what it is. But I I always have to go, oh, no, it's more than that. It's not. We're not just keeping people off the street.
Exactly. My feeling is I go to the theatre. I don't go to the synagogue or a church anymore. I go to the theatre. It's a place for me where life has a particular orientation of meaning and tends towards something that I believe is important, but I can't put my finger on it. I can't sum it up. And that's what I love about it. Do you have a kind of a mental map for how you tailor engagement, tailor programming and producing for everything from visiting Dutch superstar directors to local community around you? How do you create? Is it the same experience? Is it tailored variety of experiences? What's your philosophy?
I'm not sure I have a philosophy. I have a... The metaphor that seemed to me most useful in thinking about this area that you're asking about is friendship. I have something which I like very much. I want to share it with my friends. I have lots of friends, and anybody can be my friend. I can be friends with anybody because we have this thing that we could share, that could be in common between us. In order for the theatre to be viable, if you come to the theatre, the work that I produced, I've probably got to charge you some money for it, but I will charge you as little as I can. And we try to keep the prices as low as we could. And gradually over the years, they would edge up a little bit. But it didn't cost a lot of money to come. And we also had something which is very important for the life of that theatre, the sort of, was we gave 10% of the seats in any season were free, but not just dished down the streets. They were targeted at people who would never otherwise, or unlikely otherwise, to have thought of theatre as something they wanted to spend time doing. And when I was, there were individuals, but there were also groups of various kinds of people who marginalized. We were always looking for people on the margins to try and bring them into wherever we were. And when I was thinking about what should we do, what's next, what's the next season, what's the next show, I would have them very much in mind. And I want the work to be as ambitious as, I want to be best. I want to, you know, I want to produce the best work that anyone's producing anywhere, but I want to produce it in such a way that all those people can have a good time there. So it would happen that I go out, I'm thinking of one experience in particular, but it doesn't really matter. But I would go and see something, go, oh, there's a really interesting German director in Cologne or wherever, and go and see the work. And I go, okay, I see its value, but it's not for me, because I might, you know, have a good time or I might not have a good time, but I might see its value. But I thought, if we're saying to the young people in the estate across the road, theater is great. Actually, I know you think it's very boring, but actually, it can be great. That is going to be great. And it's going to be great for them. Otherwise, you lose them twice. And you'd sort of watch this thing sitting in wherever you were, going, I can't hand on heart say to them, this is going to add something to your life. So that is going on all the time. I mean, we're also doing, like everybody, or most people, if not everybody, work we're doing with other people. We ran a program for quite a long time in a psychiatric hospital, in a ward with young people, which was sort of specialist work, needing specialist people. But it was important to do that. We had projects, you know, again, many people are doing similar things in prisons. We had, or just local people, work for non-professional actors in our neighborhood, older people, younger people, whatever. We set up something which is very effective, which was that we would do parallel productions. I mean, in simple terms, if we did Hamlet, we would then do Young Hamlet with a young company directed by one of the younger directors that I was interested in creating some sort of relationship with young people in the studio. Or we do, I mean, it's sometimes we, you know, Enemy of the People, Ibsen, we did a 1 hour version of Enemy of the People and so on. The season in the Congo, we did but we did that maybe two or three times a year. And the great thing about that was that the young people who were in Hamlet or Enemy of the People were then world experts on that play, and then they go and see the professional production.
Were they ever better?
A good question. I don't know that they were better. They were exciting. I mean, sometimes they didn't really work out, or we'd got it wrong, or whatever. But the point of it was to try and get away from the sort of celebrity stakes or the marketplace, or we're doing this because it's meaningful for us. And that's sort of the point, really.
That kind of ineluctable move towards commodification of everything, so that the director whose work you fall in love with becomes an asset or an attribute. The actor that you think is perfect for the role has a certain market value. And as a producer, you have to weigh those factors, both the cost side and the supply side and the demand side. How much or how little does that factor into your kind of calculus?
It does. Of course it does. There are not a lot of directors that are of commercial value. I mean, Ivo van Hove is now, but they're not. He is very unusual. Yeah, that's unusual. It's the actors and maybe the writers. I mean, sometimes the writer has a vogue and people want to go and see the next thing that she or he wrote or whatever. Yeah, that can be a factor, but it's largely the actors. We didn't have to have a name in order to get an audience for a show. If we had a show which I thought was really great and which people came to see at my theatre, in other words, 400 of them a night for whatever it is, 8 or 9 weeks, it was difficult to move that, to find a wider audience for that, unless you had a name. And it was just, it was not an option to get rid of the people you had and put in some new ones. It couldn't do that. And we never tempted it. We never did that. I mean, we move shows in the West End without big names, but it's more difficult to get a wider audience for that. You've got to build up a lot of energy behind something before you launch into a very, very competitive world and a very expensive one to enter. And people have got to have the confidence to invest the money to make it possible. But we used to go, we are the stars of tomorrow. I will make them stars. We will find a way of working with them that after they work with us, everybody will want to work with them. And sometimes that was true. I mean, certainly directors, we did that. I mean, it's one of the things I am thrilled by, actually, to tell the truth, is that there are now a lot of theatres in this country which are run by younger people who we work with. Now, of course, we weren't the only people to work with them. We're one of many godparents that person had. But that's great, I think, especially people who come from backgrounds who in the past have not worked in theatre as directors very much, or producers very much. So that's great.
You definitely have a reputation for being a talent foundry. One of the things that struck me in your book was how much producerial courage you have, your ability to back ideas and people when circumstances that would seem to be improbable, if not impossible, is, must carry with it risk. It must sometimes end in tears. Not every frog can turn into a prince. I'm interested in what your relationship to risk and courage is.
You know, I guess one way of answering that is I didn't stop to think. I got excited by something and I went, let's do it. Come on, let's do it. I mean, you know, I work with very good people in every way. And what I'm saying would not have been possible if we'd not also managed a parallel financial stability. I mean, partly because we pulled off enough of these sort of crazy things, we got backing. We got, backing from the State Arts Council. Not never as much as I wanted, of course, but they got in it for quite a long period. Not always, but for quite a long period, the people who understood what we were doing and saw its value and backed it. But keeping the place financially viable was critical. I used to say to potential funders, look, I want to do the adventurous things. The phrase we used to use, it's sort of lost its value. But we used to talk about taking a leap in the dark. You got to take a leap in the dark. I can't tell you what it will be, but I think it'll be great. But I used to say, look, I want to do the adventurous things, but I want to do them next year, and I want to do them the year after that, and the year after that as well. So we will balance the books. We will do that. And I will CEO the company. I had brilliant executive people. I'm not a chartered accountant, but the final financial decisions are mine. I took everybody's advice on them, but in the end, I'd say that's what we're going to do. And it's my risk. And if I get it wrong, sack me. But it was very much to do with just keeping the energy up, just keep going. I mean, some of the work we did, I met Luc Bondy, who was a great director. Sadly, Luc died about 4 or 5 years ago now. But I saw Luc's work in Vienna, I think, originally, and in Paris. But he worked all over Europe. And I loved what I saw. And Luc became a friend very quickly. And I thought there is something in what this great director does, which is valuable to us. Luc did a show for us, and then he did another show for us. People didn't love that work in the way that I loved it. And many people liked it very much. And we played to very good houses in our limited way. But I thought it matters. We need to understand, we need to connect to what this great artist is doing. And out of the work with Luc, I got to meet Patrice Chéreau, and we did a show with Chéreau, who is a really very, very important, significant, brilliant genius of a director. And the show we did with Chéreau, some people thought was the best thing I'd ever seen in their whole lives, but other people went, I don't really get it. It's a bit boring. In the UK, anyway, in Europe, where it turned in Europe, people just were amazed by it. And it was, in my view, amazing. But you can't all the time think everything's got to be a commercial success. And I had to go, trust me, to my company and to my board and my executive people and so on. You got to trust me on this. I know you don't think it's the best thing in the whole world. I do. And I think the influence that it will have on us collectively, us as a company, but also us as a theatre culture, is important. And I was lucky because I was able to go on doing that for quite a long period of time.
What inspires you now? What adventures are you looking for?
Well, I was very lucky also in that the last year that I was running the theatre, we did, amongst the many things we did two shows which have had a long life. A play called The Inheritance by Matthew Lopez, moved into the commercial theatre and then went to Broadway and was finally cut short by the closure of Broadway. I stayed with that. I was very close to that show all the way through. I mean, from the first time I heard about it, I heard about the play. But all the way through, we did the first production of the play. I was very engaged by that play and the writer and the director and so on, the designer, everybody. And I stayed close to it all the way through, including to when it was recreated for Broadway with partly the original cast, partly other people from New York. So that took up quite a lot of my time. And another show called The Jungle, which we produced, and that is still alive. It's a show about the refugee camp in Calais, recreating a tiny little section of the camp. We did, and then it went to the West End, and then it went to St. Anne's Warehouse, and then it went to the current theatre in San Francisco. And it was due to come back to St. Anne's Warehouse, but is now on hold. But we're still working on that, and we plan to bring that back to St. Anne's Warehouse next year, when it's possible to do that again. We're also working on a film, which I'm one of the producers of. I have a big project, which I've been working on for, a couple of years now, which is theatre, but it's not in a building. It's a really big thing. I'm not going to describe it now. I don't want to jinx it any more than the world has jinxed it already, but it's a big thing. We would have been doing it now, but I'm glad we're not, for obvious reasons. We still hope to do it next year. Whether it's possible or not, I don't know. I mean, we don't know anything at the moment, but we're working on it. It involves many people in many countries. So I'm very involved with that. But mostly, I'm writing. I used to write. I mean, before I was running The Young Vic, I wrote plays, is what I did. And then I didn't write anything for 20 years. And then I wrote the book you mentioned, as if by chance. And then I started something else, which I'm in the middle of, or at least I hope I'm at least in the middle of, which I work on every day. And I've got an idea of just about got an idea of something else I want to do. So I'm writing and producing as much as I can.
It's a very different pace, I imagine, writing and producing, and a very different form of concentration.
Again, I'm very lucky. I mean, we're on lockdown here. I mean, it supposedly was released yesterday, but in a way that nobody can quite understand. But being on lockdown and writing is fine. You're even grateful.
Absolutely. I don't know that anybody actually wants to go outside anymore. As a producer, do you prefer easy projects, the ones that sort of flop into your boat, or the difficult ones that tug on the end of the line and you're never quite sure if you're going to land them?
This is a very easy thing to say, but I never wanted to repeat. If we'd done something, we'd done it. I mean, there's two aspects to it. If you've done something, you've done it. I mean, if you totally screw it up, then yes, good, have another. Go ahead. I mean, we did a show once for an adaptation of a book, and I'm not super keen on adaptations of books, but we did an adaptation of a book, and it was pretty good. And then I can't remember why, but we just went, okay, let's do that again. Let's start again. The only time we ever did it, we did the whole thing all over again. And it was sort of just about as good as the first time we did it.
It reminds me of the Borges story of the guy who recreates Don Quixote by living through it and writes out exactly the same. Yeah. Exactly the same. Was it the same, or did it have some differences?
It was different. I mean, it was the same writer doing the adaptation, the same director, but different actors. But we went, come on, this is a good idea. That was fine, but let's do it really well. And we did it sort of as well as we'd done it the first time. You go, all right, that's it. I'm not doing that one again.
No third go.
No. It's sort of slightly, I didn't regret the second go. It was interesting to do. But that was a special case. Mostly it was, there is the thing that if you do a particular kind of work, let's say a play by Arthur Miller, we'll be talking about Arthur Miller, then people go, oh, well, you did that one and that worked, so why didn't you do another one? You go, no, we've done that. That's not exciting. So that's one aspect of it. Also, it's not for the people that you're working with, the production people and everybody else that you need. What people like is going, let's do something new. But the other aspect of it, I suppose, is that if when you start producing a show, you think you know how to do it, you're lost. You think, I know how to do this one. You're dead. You're dead in water. Because the only thing that gives you a chance of doing something good is if everything you know is being called on in order to try and make the right decisions at the right moment. And if you think, oh, this is easy, you do this, you do that, we got a template, start on Tuesday, open on the Thursday, whatever, then you're dead. What was great was working with people who demanded things that we couldn't quite achieve. I mean, what people talk about is difficult directives, because you say, well, look, we can give you X number of weeks. And they say, no, I need X plus Y. And I guess the way I used to think about it is, or at least justify to the people that I work with, is that you can't hire an artist to work with you and then make it impossible for them to do the thing that they come to. If you say, look, I got a church, Michelangelo, would you kindly decorate it with, but please, I'm sick of all that oil paint. Can you do, and no people, I don't want people. You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't go, and listen, it's got to be ready by Wednesday week.
You gain a kind of omniscience when you're a producer. You gain a sense of kind of overview that the artist can't see, but it's a dislocated kind of omniscience. It doesn't have the same kind of obscurity of you're not wrestling with the angel, you're kind of reporting on the match. What's your relationship between the ideas you create and the inner needs of the artist, and how have you kind of negotiated that through your time as a producer?
Look, I'll say it, and then anybody who hears this can say that's completely rubbish. I felt I was wrestling with the angel. It was somebody else's show. I used to say, or I said once in a different context, sometimes you say the thing when somebody's asking you questions, and when you say it, you thought, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought that before. I mean, I said this once, but I'll say it again, is that everything that's successful is somebody else's success, but every failure is my failure. It has to be like that. But whether it was going to be a success in the sense that it would achieve what the artist had set out to achieve, or the collection of artists had set out to achieve, or indeed the whole team of people working on it. I mean, wrestling with nature, I wouldn't have come up with that phrase. I thought like that. It's funny, an image that comes to mind, and I think this is in the book, is when Patricia O's show opened in London. I remember that very vividly because there was the way we used to reconfigure the theatre all the time, and for Chereau's show, there was a sort of gangway between the audience and the wall of the theatre that had never existed before, that was built into the way we designed the show. And I was standing in this gangway, which I'd never been able to do before, with an unusual proximity to both the stage and the audience. I can see myself standing there, but absolutely going, oh God, I'm not a religious person, I don't pray. But there was a technical aspect of the show which was tricky, and I wasn't sure we were entirely in control of it. Okay, oh, let that work. I mean, it's not unusual for a producer, I think, to be so deeply invested. But no, I would suggest things. I mean, I would suggest things, but you try to immerse yourself in it. But not, here's where I think it links to what you just said, is that it's not, you're not thinking, if I was doing this, if I was directing the show, this is what I'd do. That's irrelevant. What you're trying to do is understand what's going on in these people's minds, and can I help to get it there? I mean, sometimes you're just moving obstructions out of the way. Yeah, yes, you can have another week. Yes, you can have, yes, we can shift things around in order to make the actor who wasn't available, whatever. But looking back on it, it was a compulsion, really. You have to do that. That is what you've taken on. And sometimes you can't. And sometimes you fail, or sometimes you say something which is stupid or not of any help. But that was the pleasure of it. That was the fun of it.
Is it any coincidence that your first book was about spirit mediums? It sounds like it's a kind of theatrical equivalent, that you're kind of channeling the spirit of the director or the latent production.
There may be something in that. I mean, I remember I'd done an undergraduate degree in social anthropology, and I wanted to do research. And I had an idea of what I wanted to do, which was in Mozambique. This is a very long time ago. And I had a particular political interest in what was happening there. But I happened to be in somebody else's house. And there was a television set. Like, it was on the floor. I don't know why it was on the floor. It was on the floor, and it happened to be on. And I was caught by a report, a news report, about the guerrilla army fighting against the white regime in what was then Rhodesia, that the guerrillas were in some way linking up to spirit mediums. And I was hooked by that. I just thought, yeah, okay, that's okay. I know nothing about that, but there's something in that that interested me. And I ended up spending a couple of years on that. And as you say, I wrote a book about that. I mean, I don't know. I never really thought about it. I mean, there is a bit in my book, is it by chance, about a spirit medium. And I wrote that for this book, and I tried to suggest the way in which this man who believes himself to be possessed by a particular spirit, and the people that he lived amongst went along with that belief. They believed that too. But I told the story, I hope accurately, to suggest the way I thought he was manipulating the circumstances he was in order to achieve what he wanted to achieve through a kind of performance that he was giving, which is not to say that he was a charlatan. I don't believe he was. It was entirely within the culture of the people that he should use this set of actions and performances in order to talk to them about what he thought was important. But there was a kind of theatre going on.
In a sense, he was a producer. I mean, he was creating a mixture of authentic magic and a bit of showmanship at the
absolutely,
same time.
Absolutely. And like a producer, he was also engaged with his social status. And he was working out how he was going to live.
I'm really just interested in any advice you have for people starting out, unless you want to tell them not to, in which case I'd rather you kept that to yourself. Anything you want to share with somebody who's thinking, well, maybe I'll wake up and try and make something happen. What would your advice to them be?
I certainly wouldn't say don't do it, because I had the best time, and I hope to produce some more things at some point. No, it's a fantastically rewarding way to live and work. I fell into it, but I trained as an actor. I directed a little bit, a tiny bit, when I grew up in South Africa, and I did a little bit of work there. And then I did a whole bunch of other things. But I was writing plays. I worked with a lot of different directors. A lot of different directors directed the plays that I wrote. So I watched a lot of other artists working. And then I worked alongside a really very distinguished artistic director and producer at the Royal Court for a couple of years. Also, I mean, the guy I live with, Nicholas Wright, and have done for a very, very, very long time. Nick started Theatre Upstairs at the Royal Court and was artistic director of the Royal Court for a couple of years. So I've been in that world for a long time. And though when I found myself running a theatre, aged almost 50, I'd never done it before. I'd been around a lot. And I got a sense of what I liked and what I didn't like, and what I admired, what I didn't admire. And I suppose what I'd seen, especially working with Stephen Daldry at the Court for 2 or 3 years, is looking at the way in which, though, as you say, you are producing somebody else's ideas, it is possible for the producer's personality to be very strong, right? But as much as you say, it's not about me, you forget about me. And you know, some producers put themselves right at the top of the billing, correctly, Sam Goldwyn or Joe Papp or whatever it is. But it's not different from writing a poem. The artist you work with, the money that you have to raise, it's all part of just trying to make something and make something happen. And then the audience that you partly find and partly create for the work. It's very creative. I remember, again, many, many years ago, just when I was starting out at running a theatre, going to a conference or some such about creative producing. And one of the questions was, is there such a thing as a creative producer, right? And I remember thinking, what are you talking about? Obviously.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous question. But it was like, no, there is another kind of producer who does what? I mean, there are people who just go, well, it doesn't matter what they do. But the only way that's worth doing it is if it demands absolutely everything that you have to give. And the more you learn and the more you know, and the more you know about theatre, making a theatre, all the arts, any art, the more you know, the more you've got in your reserve to call on. I'm not a, you know, my father was a businessman. I knew a little bit about running a business, not a lot, but a little bit. But you have a sort of sense of what that means. What is a budget? What is a balance sheet? What is balancing the books? What does it mean? You know, the more you got all that, the more authority you can have to control what it is you want to do. And you do try to take control. I mean, you really try to take control. But the point of your control is to give other people control over what they're doing. You know, the market is such a, you know, you talked about commoditizing everything. Yeah, that is the enemy. That is the enemy. It's about people. It's about connecting. It's about relationships between people. It's the imagery of friendship is the imagery of the gift, of a gift exchange. That's very sustaining. You're making friends with people through art, through theatre. You want to share. That's the language which is sustaining. Yeah. I don't know why more people don't do it, but there are. I mean, in the UK, there are fantastic creative producers, some of whom are entirely commercial. But there are, I mean, Cameron McIntosh is a genius producer, And Cameron, who I don't know very well, but I know a little bit about Cameron's engagement with every single thing that he does. And not only the first production, but the second production, the 10th production, and the 20th version of it, or the 30th version of it, that's touring South Korea or is touring Guatemala, or, you know, it's absolutely in there. And that it's got to be that thing that he loves. It's got to be that thing. It's a wonderful thing. It's an artistic thing. He's also a genius at making lots of money out of it, but that's his particular genius. But it's that degree of, I don't know, love for what you do, that it has to be what you want it to be or you die. I'm exaggerating. You don't die. You just feel a bit miserable, which is not the same thing.
I'm Yaron Lifshitz, and you've been listening to Producing Heroes, the Circa podcast, produced by Lauren Isaacson. If you've been listening on Apple Podcasts, please consider writing a review. And if you like what you've heard, you can find us on social media at Circa Contemporary Circus, #producingheroes.